The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, originally airing July 28, 2017. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs radio program produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The show is podcast at globalresearch.ca and airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. This week, as part of our 2017 summer series, we air audio from a roundtable discussion presented as part of Project Censored's 40th anniversary celebrations. The Project Censored's Media Freedom Summit was held on October 21st and 22nd, 2016 at Sonoma State University, where the nonprofit Media Watchdog was founded. The roundtable discussion featured four prominent figures who have contributed in profound ways to our current understanding of media's role in shaping the public's understanding of the challenges facing our society and our world. Abby Martin is the creator and host of The Empire Files, a weekly investigative news program airing on Telesur English. She is the past host of RT's Breaking the Set and the co-founder of the independent citizen journalism project known as Media Roots. Minar Mohawash is the founder and editor-in-chief of Minneapolis-based independent media outlet Mint Press News. She also hosts Behind the Headlines for that news outlet. Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and author of numerous articles on media censorship and election fraud. David Talbot is the best-selling author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and America's Secret Government. He's the founding editor of Salon.com. His most recent endeavor is Hot Books, a new imprint in partnership with Skyhorse Publishing, putting out titles on key contemporary issues, often escaping the attention of the mainstream media. Abby Martin functioned as the moderator for this discussion and will be the first voice heard in this broadcast. Just an advisory, some coarse language is used in this discussion. Listener discretion is advised.
Does everyone remember in 2014 when the U.S. government squarely, actually, and I think there was some retaliation, said that North Korea hacked Sony in retaliation for the interview? Do you guys remember that? Huh. That turned out to be complete bullshit. All right, it was an insider from Sony trying to embarrass the CEOs there or whatever. Was there ever an apology? Was there ever a press conference? Was there ever anything in the establishment press saying, you know what, that wasn't North Korea, that was Sony executives, we're sorry about that? So I think that when we're hearing that Russia's hacking our elections and it's this insane detraction from, you know, the rigging of the actual election, and we'll talk about that word and how it's been hijacked too, but I think that we should all take a step back and just remember that we've been lied to over and over and over again. And when the establishment's on a beat, we have to ask why. I wanted to turn it over to Mark first, and this is an amazing panel, by the way. Everyone, if you don't know who these people are, definitely get into their work. Mark, incredible to have you here. New York University professor, media studies, incredible inspiration to me. Mark, you grew up during the Cold War, and you've been a media analyst for a long time, and I wanted your insight on why you think this is pumping up now, because it's not like we're fighting a communist state anymore. You know, it's an oligarchic capitalist.
Right. Well, it is mind-boggling. I mean, I've been studying the media as a critic since the late 70s, right? And as you note, I grew up during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I can't say I've ever seen anything like what we're living through now, you know, for the mind-boggling mendacity of the stories we're hearing. I mean, absolute fantasies flung at us as gospel truth, for the stridency of the propaganda, and for the unanimity of the propaganda. And by that I mean not only that the corporate press seems to be univocal, you know, everybody basically reading from the same script, but also for the fact that the entertainment media and the so-called left press often re-echoes what we're getting from the mainstream. You know, you can get the same vision of Putin, for example, as a kind of, you know, reincarnation of Stalin, mm-hmm. from House of Cards, you know, in its worst season, second season, and from Saturday Night Live,
yeah.
Right? They play it for laughs. That you get from the so-called liberal media. And then it's variously re-echoed, you know, by Amy Goodman and others. It's deeply troubling and extremely dangerous, to say the least. I wanted to... Thank you. Thank you for applauding that sentiment. I want to read something, because I had a feeling you were going to ask me about this. This is a very sobering passage from the Berlin Diary by the great CBS newsman William Shirer. When he was over in Berlin from 34 to 41, he kept this diary clandestinely, kind of like Winston Smith, you know, in 1984, and he smuggled it home with him, and it became a big bestseller. And I don't know, this would probably strike some people as provocative, but I have a feeling that in this room, where I feel unusually at home and remarkably relieved to be here, I think that you'll take the point. This is from August 10th, 1939. How completely isolated a world the German people live in. A glance at the newspapers yesterday and today reminds you of it. Whereas all the rest of the world considers that the peace is about to be broken by Germany, that it is Germany that is threatening to attack Poland over Danzig, here in Germany, in the world the local newspapers create, the very reverse is being maintained. Not that it surprises me, but when you're away for a while, you forget. What the Nazi papers are proclaiming is this, that it is Poland which is disturbing the peace of Europe. Poland, which is threatening Germany with armed invasion, and so forth. This is the Germany of last September, when the steam was turned on Czechoslovakia. Poland, look out, warns the BZ headline, adding, answer to Poland, the runner amok against peace and right in Europe. Or the headline in Der Führer, daily paper of Karlsruhe, which I brought on the train. Warsaw threatens bombardment of Danzig. Unbelievable agitation of the Polish arch madness. For perverse perversion of the truth, this is good. You ask, but the German people can't possibly believe these lies. Then you talk to them. So many do. Okay? Now, I think this is exactly like what we're getting now, right? You've got a coup in Ukraine, demonstrably quarterbacked by Hillary Clinton's State Department. We have the evidence. It's clear, right? We know this is a fact because the conversation between Victoria Nuland at the State Department and Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Kiev, is explicit. They are managing the coup. They're picking out those Ukrainian politicians who are going to comprise the next government, right? This is reported in the New York Times as evidence of Russian hacking. That's the way they cover the story. Mm-hmm. And the response from the White House is they're very concerned that the Russians would take this liberty. Nothing about the content, does it sound familiar, right? Nothing about the content of the material. Then, a politician in Estonia, there's another hacked phone conversation, tells Catherine Ashton of the EU about the fact that many people in Ukraine believe that the massacre by snipers of people in Maidan Square was actually the work of the coup plotters, not the work of the corrupt president's police. This wasn't even mentioned in the New York Times or anywhere else. This is explicit evidence that the United States is the aggressor in Ukraine, that we started it, that this is part of the general encirclement, right, of Russia by NATO, right? We're all over the... Nevertheless, what we get in the United States press is exactly the opposite, that, Putin is invading Ukraine. No, Putin has invaded Ukraine. There's been an invasion of Ukraine. You all remember this invasion of Ukraine, right? Big invasion of Ukraine. Evidence came forward, pictorial evidence, photographic evidence, all of it exposed outside the pages of the New York Times, etc., as fake. It was all bogus. The sky is crammed with military drones. You'd think they'd find a photograph of this invasion of Ukraine, right? which hasn't taken place. It never happened. The same with the seizure of Crimea. I could go on. I could go on. The fact is that on the basis of decades and decades of anti-Soviet propaganda, right, which, you know, builds up in the minds of millions of Americans as a kind of sediment, on that foundation then, the government and the press together push this new image of Putin as a dangerously expansive Soviet Russian dictator, a strong man, right? A guy who murders journalists, right? We hear this over and over and over again, and the frightening thing is that so many people, so many educated people, so many liberal Democrats, you know, just like the biggest dullards walking around the United States in 1953, the most credulous members of Joe McCarthy's audience, there is no difference. Everybody believes it 100%. That's frightening, okay? That is an example. That's just one example of the many ways in which the problem that Project Censored deals with poses a serious threat to our welfare. Right? Every horrible thing that's going on now is arguably the result of the failure of our press to do its duty under the First Amendment. Whether it's this freak show of a presidential race, the total corruption of our voting system, whether it's the, you know, daily summary execution of American citizens by our police, whether it's the prison industrial complex that we see around us. The longest prison strike in American history has been going on for a month. It never gets any coverage whatsoever. Whether it's the ongoing public health catastrophe of the MMR vaccine, okay? That may strike some people in here as a crackpot notion. That response is also based on yet another staggeringly successful propaganda drive by our free press. Right? And as you say, Abby, it's absolutely true. The propaganda is all the more effective for the fact that we appear to have a free media system independent of the government, mm-hmm. that it is not state-controlled. We hear this endlessly. You know, there's the Russian state-controlled media, the Chinese state-controlled media, Venezuela, Iran. It's state-controlled, not like us, okay? But see, propaganda always works particularly well. It's at its most effective when it comes at you as something other than propaganda. See? That's a fact. So RT, I mean, it doesn't make any secret of its connection to the Russian government. It's overt. And for that very reason, I think, its people tend to function more professionally as journalists than these abysmal hacks who work, you know, throughout the American press, which represents itself as free, as independent, okay? Well, you know, if that's an example of an independent press, then we're all completely children present. We're screwed. You know what I'm saying? We're absolutely screwed.
I'm going to jump in here, and I think that I'm going to move it over to David. Because, David, you've researched the CIA so extensively. I mean, what is your response when you see Hillary standing up there and, like Mark was saying, deflecting from the content of the leaks and just continuing to say, how dare Russia usurp our elections, undermine our democracy, steer, you know, this whole country? It's like, man, how many times has the CIA interfered in other countries' governments and elections?
Yeah, it's the height of hypocrisy. Well, you know, I agree with much of what has been said here. I must say, though, that I, as an independent journalist, wouldn't really like working in Putin's Russia or Ukraine either. I have a friend who runs a Ukrainian publication, and two of her lovers and partners have been assassinated in Ukraine. There's lots of intrigue, political intrigue and violence there. But I do believe that RT in this country plays a very useful role, because I agree with Mark that our own media system is so heavily propagandized and corporate controlled and gets more and more carnival-like every day, that it's basically useless at this point as a vehicle for useful civic information. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, give the impression that I think other countries have more open you know, systems of journalism. And I would certainly also have deep problems with most countries. I think that obviously the, you know, the national security state is our religion. We live in a country that's been at permanent war throughout my life that begins to eat away, rot away at the soul of a democracy. There's no way that you can have an empire in a permanent state of war and have a viable democracy. So we're now in a situation where we have a campaign that doesn't ever discuss the elephant in the room, that we don't ever discuss peace and war anymore. When I was young, when I was the age of students here, we were in the streets all the time. We had an anti-war movement. We had media that actually was forced to cover the anti-war movement because the protests were large and very disruptive. We lost, but we won. It's complicated. But certainly today we don't have oppositional movement that way that raises the questions about should this country still be involved in the Middle East? Should we still have boots on the ground invading Mosul? I mean, we're invading Mosul again. Don't you feel you're in Groundhog Day in this country? It's unbelievable. And yet I don't see the outrage there. And yes, partly and to a great extent, it's the fault of our media that's bought and paid for. I see people that I train, that I help train at Salon, who are now on CNN, Jake Tapper and others, and they're just part of the same tapestry, you know? And you get to be kind of, frankly, fatalistic at some point and go, you know, where are the conscience of these journalists? And why aren't they challenging authority more aggressively? But what it comes down to, and what it always comes down to, is like the old you know, motto that Scoop Nisker, the great, you know, hippie journalist from the 60s and 70s up till the current day in the Bay Area, he had the saying that he signed off with on radio, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. And my feeling always as a journalist, from the time I was in high school, creating, you know, a student journal that got me thrown out of my high school, was we've got to create our own media. Because once you go inside the belly of that beast, there's no way to do viable work for any extended period of time that challenges authority, that challenges conventional wisdom without being punished and sidelined. I was just on stage with Chris Hedges, the great Chris Hedges in Berkeley the other night. And of course, Chris was in the belly of the beast for years at the New York Times and did terrific work as a foreign correspondent and challenged Israel and challenged the State Department again and again on his reporting in the Middle East and the Balkans. But, you know, Chris ultimately did have to make a decision to leave because his life was becoming unviable at the New York Times. And so the challenge is, can we create the alternate institutions that reach people, that have an effect, that become part of the national dialogue? I started Salon for that reason, and we did for a while, I think had a run at that, because we had original journalism that was running counter to the mainstream sort of narrative, and we challenged that. We paid for investigative journalism. And then what happened was Arianna Huffington business model took over. Hey, I'm not going to pay anything for anybody, and I'm going to become a millionaire. And she did. And that business model won out. And then clickbait took over instead of deep investigative journalism. And so now I look at this kind of thing that I helped create, the digital news culture, and I'm really deeply dismayed, except for pockets like us here and there, people doing the work. But, you know, to really be in the mix, you have to build a professional newsroom. You have to build a newsroom where there's journalists who are trained, who are experienced, who are capable of going out and doing the legwork and the investigative work and pulling the documents and, frankly, working with hackers. Because, as Chris said, there are no leakers anymore in government. They're so closely monitored. We live in such a repressive state at this point that whistleblowers can't even do what they want to do, their patriotic duty, without being busted by the government. They're constantly being surveilled and monitored. The lid is so tight now. So we need people like Julian Assange, and this blowback against Assange is very dangerous. And how the left has bought into it and has vilified him. Because he and the hacker culture is the only thing standing between us and complete ignorance about the way that power really works. So two things I'll leave you with, and then I'm done for now, is yes, we have to build our own media, and we have to continue to encourage and support the hacker culture, because there is no democracy at this point without that free flow of information.
Yeah, I totally agree, and it disturbs me greatly that his internet was shut off, and wow, that's insane. I mean, that's a human right, so I'm really curious to see what's going to happen next, and it's really sad if the Ecuadorian government cowtailed to the empire on that one. Trying to ask my bosses about that, Telesaur. Manar, I want to turn to you because you have a really interesting story. Similarly to me, you have been viciously attacked in the establishment press because you have been at the forefront of cutting through the Syrian war propaganda push. 2 years ago, the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, even Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who wrote the anthrax speech for Colin Powell at the UN, told me that it's completely unfounded and everyone in the intelligence community knows that it was not Assad that carried out that attack. Manar was on the front lines with that story and came under insane heat for publishing it. Manar, first I wanted you to talk about that story and also talk about, you know, you've been covering the propaganda since, and this is one of the hotbeds of propaganda right now, where it's extremely hard to sort through the deluge every day coming at us. So talk a little bit about what happened to you and what's been happening since in the country. Oh, sorry.
No, thank you. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank everybody for being here today, and I'm absolutely honored to be sitting among some amazing journalists here and professors and media literacy experts. I'm sure many of you have heard the fight for Aleppo, the fight for now Mosul, the fight for Kirkuk, and the fight for, I would say, Ghouta, the Ghouta chemical attacks. And I would like to piggyback on the point that David just made that you know, we need journalists to be on the front lines to really challenge the government narratives that promote and justify wars. Well, Mint Press was on the front line of that propaganda to challenge the narratives of war when it came to Syria. When the Ghouta chemical weapons attack took place, we had a journalist on the ground, actually two journalists on the ground, by the name of Dale Gavlek and Yahya Ababne. And immediately, they 2 days after the Obama administration had said that they were going to, that Assad had crossed the red line and had committed basically a chemical weapons attack against his own people, that he was gassing his own people. Our reporters on the ground actually interviewed people, Syrians in Ghouta. They interviewed rebels themselves that were part of al-Nusra Front, who were occupying many parts of Ghouta. And they had spoken to these people on the ground, and they were at the heart of this story. 2 days after President Obama had made this announcement that Assad had gassed his own people, he had crossed that red line, and that we, the United States, were going to take war action in Syria, and we're ready to start airstriking to get rid of the Assad government. And our reporters spoke to these people on the ground, and what they told us completely changed the course of history and the war narrative inside Syria. We spoke to people on the ground, and they had told us that the rebels, very specifically the al-Nusra Front, were being provided chemical weapons capabilities from the Saudi Arabian government and the Turkish government. And of course, when we published this report, the story, of course, went completely viral within just a couple of minutes. Our website had crashed because we were getting over 100,000 unique visitors every 3 minutes to our site. And we had to ask antiwar.com to host the story on their website. And of course, all the traffic had gone to their website. And we were kind of panicking and trying to figure out how we can get our website back up. But there we were, a very small, independent, six-month-old news watchdog journalism organization in Minneapolis, Minnesota, led by me, a 25-year-old Muslim Palestinian American journalist, the first of its kind. And thank you. And we had done what no other news agency in the United States had done, which was to challenge that narrative of war. And what we saw happen when that story went viral was so amazing, because the fact that we were getting so much traffic from not just the United States, but all around the world, and it was being talked about on every media channel or, you know, an organization across the globe, except, of course, the major news organizations here in the United States, was a huge sign that people didn't want another war. People were so tired of the propaganda. They were so tired of the lies that we were being fed to justify that war. And so it was a very, very amazing feeling. But 2 days after we published the story, our reporter who wrote the story and translated the story, Dale Gavlecht, had received a phone call from the Associated Press, who she had also worked with. She was a stringer. She freelanced for Mint Press, and she freelanced also for the Associated Press. And they had called her and said, "What are you doing putting your name on the story? You need to get your name off of the story." And I don't think they told her the reason why, but she immediately called us and said, "I believe that the Saudis themselves have contacted the Associated Press and have demanded that they get away from this story." Because in her byline, it had said that she worked for the Associated Press, which gave the story a little bit more clout since we were a very new journalism startup. And she immediately said, "There's no way I'm going to remove my name. Like, this is our story. We did this, and I'm proud of it. And, you know, we don't want to be a part of the next war." Literally an hour later, I got a phone call from Dale, trembling in fear. She had received another phone call from the Associated Press saying that if she did not remove her name off of the story, that they would end her career and she would be done. And, of course, we didn't know what to do with this. I was a new editor and we were a very small staff and we didn't really know what we were doing. All we knew is that we had stopped the first war from happening. But just a couple of weeks after the story had gone viral, Dale Gavlecht came under the pressure and she retracted her involvement in the story. And of course, I came out and made public statements that yes, she wrote the story and so forth. But immediately to discredit the story, the media establishment here in the United States, from the BuzzFeeds and several other so-called leftist news organizations that were parroting these war narratives to justify the war in Syria, came and attacked me directly. And of course, it was nothing more than an assassination, a character assassination. And they used the fact that I was young. I was a 25-year-old woman. They used the fact that I was a woman. They used the fact that I was Muslim. I wore hijab. All of these things against me to try to distract from the true contents of the story and smear me and Mint Press as this Assad front in the United States and this Russian, agency that was being funded by Putin. So it was very similar to what Abby had gone through. But the story of the Ghouta chemical weapons attack is still an ongoing story. And I'm not talking about just with Ghouta, but I'm talking about the narrative of that war in Syria to get more U.S. involvement into that region continues, and it keeps transforming. And it does feel like Groundhog's Day almost every couple of weeks. The story moved from Ghouta, then it moved to fighting ISIS, and then it moved to recapturing Aleppo. And something that we need to remember about Aleppo, which is what is so important here, is that Aleppo is not one city. Aleppo has been split up into two. And the media has really painted the story of Aleppo as besieged and is basically the Russian government and the Assad government are raining down bombs on innocent civilians. And now we have the White Helmets who work very closely with Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra Front inside Aleppo, who are actually being funded by USAID and other British organizations to kind of control the narrative about Syria. Aleppo, the story of Aleppo that we're not being told is that eastern Aleppo is only 200,000 people. It's occupied by over about 200,000 people. The rest of the people have actually fled. They fled because Al-Nusra Front and Al-Qaeda, who are now openly receiving funding and arms from the U.S. government, have taken over the city and have actually besieged the city. And that's the story behind Aleppo that we've been challenging. And of course, we have been continuing to challenge the war against Syria. And these attacks by the media continue. And the more we talk about Syria, the more we are vindicated, of course, by the Hillary emails and how the CIA was on the ground in Syria fomenting unrest there and arming rebels and creating the sectarian civil strife there.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing a roundtable discussion from Project Censored's Media Freedom Summit, celebrating the nonprofit news watchdog's 40th anniversary. It was held the evening of Friday, October 21st at Sonoma State University. The speakers were Abby Martin, Manar Mohawish, Professor Mark Crispin Miller, and David Talbot. Here's more from that talk.
I wanted to follow up on that story about the AP's threat to professionally assassinate your colleague, and I want to use that to respond to your just point about the real physical danger that reporters are in places like Ukraine. I think it's important for us to recognize that in order to protect propaganda narratives on which a tremendous amount of money depends, the state and its enablers in the press very often will go to almost any lengths. Now, I wish I could say that in the United States, journalists are never at physical risk the way they are in places like Ukraine or Iran or other places like that. But we know from the story of Michael Hastings and many other reporters, all too many other reporters, you know, going all the way back to Dorothy Kilgallen and Charles Horman in Chile and Danny Casalero, Gary Webb, whose story is a little bit different, but all too similar. I mean, it can be, existentially dangerous to reporters to go too far in exposing the falseness of an important narrative. But for the most part, it doesn't work that way. It works through the use of an extremely effective propaganda meme that we'll be talking about tomorrow at the panel with the great Lance DeHaven Smith, and that is the conspiracy theory meme. If anyone dares to raise any questions about these all-important narratives on which billions of dollars depend, they are finished professionally. They will be tagged conspiracy theorists, and as I say, tomorrow we'll be talking about precisely how the CIA managed to make that happen, because the agency was actually behind the spread of that meme throughout U.S. journalistic discourse, specifically in the late 60s, in order to protect the propaganda narrative of the Warren Commission report. You know, it was people like Mark Lane and Edward J. Epstein were raising, you know, questions. You write about this, about that report, completely legitimate questions that to this day are controversial in the mainstream press. The agency came up with the brilliant idea of getting its propaganda assets and friends in the media to demonstrate that these were conspiracy theorists, cranks, and that their assets should use the following five arguments to discredit this work. And these are arguments that are still being used today, you know? So the problem is compounded by the problem of the state's ruthless protection of these propaganda narratives is now compounded by the fact that we have the internet, we have Mint Press News, we have, you know, RT, Telesur available online, you know, we had Salon and so on. The Intercept, exactly. Counterpunch, right? Mm-hmm. This makes the task of protecting these propaganda narratives basically impossible, you know? And I can say, I mean, you know, I'm not known for my cheerier sentiments, but I have to say that it is, you know, tremendously hopeful as far as I'm concerned that we now live in a media culture where it's possible instantaneously to get the other side of the story. And this has had a dramatic effect on the attitudes of young people, right? We've heard some terrific students here tonight. I can attest from my own experience in the classroom that students are noticeably less intimidated by the conspiracy theory meme than they used to be, because it's so easy now to get the truth, you know? This, I think, in part accounts for that bizarre and often terrifying stridency with which the press is now attacking people like us, you know? Abby knows, and some of the other people in this room know, that Vice is actually trying to get me fired from my job at NYU because of my affiliation with the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, this is a story I can tell at some other time. It's pretty funny, actually. Oh, that I'm going to be fired? No. Okay.
That's cold.
That's really cold. I don't know what I did to you to deserve that. At any rate, you know, the point is that telling the truth is always difficult, right? I mean, ask Socrates. It's always difficult. It's extremely difficult in conditions of empire, and it's extremely difficult in conditions of empire threatened, which is basically what we have today.
Abby, can I just...
Sure,
thanks.
Sure.
I just wanted to, because I didn't fully answer your question earlier about CIA manipulation of the media. And so, yeah, this clearly continues. I wrote about it in my latest book, going back to the Cold War days, and Mark alluded to some of that. I mean, I found after the Warren Commission released its report on the JFK assassination, Alan Dulles, conveniently, the former head of the CIA who had been fired by Kennedy, was sitting on the Warren Commission. And Newsweek, the head of the Washington Bureau of Newsweek, I found correspondence in Alan Dulles' own papers at Princeton, the head of the Washington Bureau of Newsweek went to Dulles and said, would you please basically vet what we're doing here when the Warren Report comes out? Will you read what we're writing about it here, the coverage, because we're under a tight deadline and we need your expert opinion. So basically they gave before in advance of publication their coverage of the Warren Report to Alan Dulles, a person who had a dog in that fight, let's say. to look at. And then the guy writes to him afterwards, thank you, Mr. Dulles. We could never have done it on a deadline without you basically editing and reviewing our coverage of the Warren Report. So that continues to today. I have a book that I published by the great Nicholas Skow, who's an investigative reporter who wrote about Gary Webb, in fact, in Kill the Messenger, which was made into a great movie that no one saw, strangely. It was dumped by Hollywood, Focus Features. And it's a terrific film, though, and you should all see it and read the book. But his new book for Hot Books, my imprint, is called Spooked, and it goes into great detail about how the CIA continues to this day manipulate the media. The media has become even more craven in some ways now because media has been downsized. There are fewer and fewer jobs. Those jobs that still are, particularly the elite jobs for the leading newspapers that have the resources to cover national security, are in big demand. And the only way that you keep those jobs as if you play ball with Langley. I mean, that's everyone knows that. So Nick goes into great detail. He got some national security reporters from the Times and other places to actually give him honest interviews. It's very interesting. And, of course, Hollywood now is a big part of this equation. So whether it's series like Homeland or movies like Zero Dark Thirty, there's great and you know intense cooperation between Hollywood producers and the CIA and all this. And then the final response I wanted to say to another question: why is this happening now, Abby? That you know the new Cold War, the new hysteria about Russia. I think it's because we were allowed to remake the Middle East along the neocon lines that had been planned for years by PNAC, that group, and basically the plan for Iraq, for Afghanistan, and Libya was all put into effect. The last, bowling pin standing was Syria, and Russia got involved there. And that frustrated, the ambitions to complete the map in the sort of neocon vision that Bush and others and Cheney had in mind and continued throughout the Obama administration. And so when Russia got in our way in Syria, that's when all hell started to break loose. That's when they were truly demonized.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Hillary's continued call for a no-fly zone is extremely dangerous, and she keeps doubling down on it. At this point, it's batshit crazy because it actually means a direct confrontation, not only with Syria, but with Russia. They have bases in Syria. We have bases in, 700 bases around the world? That was one of the Project Censored story this year, is, 70% percent of nations. I mean, it's absolutely insane, the reach of the U.S. empire, and to deflect this to Russia is pretty astounding. And Hillary continues to double down on this point that would cause mass civilian casualties. She even said it herself to private banking CEOs that it would kill lots of Syrians. So that's her private position.
I just wanted to add a point about the smears and the attacks that go against journalists that we undergo. You know, censorship doesn't just come in the form of a story not being covered. It also comes in the form of these attacks, these continuous attacks against journalists that we saw with our reporter, Dale Gavlak, with the ridiculous smears that took place against our reporter, Yahya Ababna, and the continuous, caricature that has been crafted about Mint Press as this Assad agency or this Russian agency, this Iranian agency in the United States. These kinds of smears are created and they are perpetrated because they want us as reporters to stop doing what we're doing. They want to silence us. We're seeing that now with Julian Assange. He's being painted as this Russian agent, and he's promoting Trump, even though he's helping expose our rigged electoral system. So I was really, really, really excited to find out about Project Censored, because for so long, I had, at the time when I was first attacked by BuzzFeed, who... the writer of the article, of course, is a notorious neocon who's tied to the State Department and tied to actually PNAC, Rosie Gray. we all know Rosie Gray. But when I was first attacked through this character assassination, it felt really, really lonely. I had some of my own staff turn against me because they were worried. I mean, they're from Minnesota, suburban Minnesota. They were worried. This was the most exciting thing and the scariest thing that they had probably ever dealt with. But they were worried about their reputation. And I think that for a lot of journalists who are in it for the name, who are in it for, as a career journalist, they're worried about their reputation. And so I lost a lot of friends. I had people from leftist medias email me, specifically from Occupy Wall Street and from others I won't name, who said to me, Manar, we read those articles about you and we're just not too comfortable working with you anymore. And, just no hard feelings. And, I almost want to cry because I really felt so alone for so long. And then with the constant, media propaganda that was being perpetrated against Muslims constantly, it just feels like, you don't have allies in the system. And of course, I met Abby right away, and she was really excited to share our story and hear about what we had gone through. And then through Abby, I actually met Mickey. And so I really, really am touched by everybody that's here today and by these groups of people and by what Project Censored is doing. It really, when I saw, what I had written in Project Censored, I honestly was brought to tears because for 3 years, we were continuously being smeared and attacked by the very people that we thought were on our side, and they weren't on our side. They were in journalism for the name, for the reputation. They weren't in it for the real mission, and that's why I always advocate for an alternative to the alternative media, which is what Mint Press is trying to do. So thank you so much.
I know how that loneliness feels when Lawrence O'Donnell is calling you a conspiracy theorist with a Jamie fucking Kirchick on TV, this rat who's like the troll who runs around and tries to shape all these narratives. He's also an FBI member, which is the spawn of PNAC. And once you learn all these players, you start to kind of get emboldened, being called a truther, conspiracy theorist, and a Russian agent. Kind of take it as a badge of honor at this point. You should be proud because they have nothing else to go on and they can't attack any facts that you say. And that's insane. So I wanted to talk about
this. But they have endless resources, which we don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course. And Manar made a really good point about the intent of a lot of journalists in the establishment is they are in it for the career. It is an establishment kind of hackery when a lot of the journalists that I talk to are totally outside of the system because it's from their heart. It's hard to sell yourself out and take that route because you know how many conflicts of interest, how much advertising is going to be pushed and shoved down your throat, and you're not going to be able to do the work that you know you need to if you really want to be a real journalist, so many of them are never promoted or uplifted, and that's what Project Censored really does, and so happy to have you guys all here. I wanted to talk about the dog and pony show of our elections right now and about the Podesta emails that are coming out, because like David said, I mean, this is, you know, hackers have kind of become our news source, the raw source, because whistleblowers are punished, of course, even more under Obama. And I think it's fascinating how little, I was looking up the Podesta emails, and other than a couple people who are actually searching them themselves and posting clips on Twitter and stuff like that, it's so hard to find any progressive or leftist outlets that are covering them at all. Like literally only Breitbart and a couple other just like alt-right blogs and stuff are picking up on these. And so, of course, the vast majority of people are going to say, oh, I don't trust those sources. This is all biased. The leaks are fake. You have Donna Brazile actually making that audacious claim, completely unfounded. And, you know, and also this rigging of the election thing, how people are mocking Trump for saying that. I think it's very funny. And Mark could speak to this because, you know, everyone said the election was rigged this whole time. I mean, this is the whole system's rigged. What do you mean the election's rigged? Everything's rigged. That's why we have Trump and Clinton to choose from. So I find it really interesting that these terms, you know, when pressed, all the cynical punditry sitting in their ivory towers are saying there's nothing newsworthy in these leaks. Yeah. Well, maybe for you assholes there aren't, but for us, it's shocking. I mean, this is all pay-to-play insider baseball stuff where you're finding out that people are getting questions in advance. The Clinton Foundation, they're giving favors to the Dubai king. I mean, all of this stuff is out there. And it's very shocking. I wanted to get your guys's, Mark, I wanted to talk to you about just kind of the rigging mockery, you know, especially since that's one of the stories in Project Censored is the algorithmic shaping of our views online, the Google searches, what are we actually getting? And also the voting, not the voting fraud, of course, that's a fake issue, but the election fraud. And I wanted each of you to just comment on, you know, this whole thing that Trump almost seems like he is an outsider, that he's this anti-establishment candidate because no one's covering it. I mean, the Clinton machine is at full force. The media is 100% on board with Clinton, and it makes him almost seem like this outsider.
Well, yeah, I mean, it almost does. of course, he's, you know, I mean, he's been an insider
as
for years.
As much as a billionaire can be. Yeah.
Right. Well, right. And of course, you know, the Clintons asked for money from him. I mean, we know all this stuff. I mean, well, we don't all know it. A few of us know it. Their daughters are best friends, right? I mean, they're just a wonderful bunch of human beings, you know. Can we just hear it for them, please? Thank you. Yes, for the Trumps, the Clintons. Yeah, really, I hope nobody ate before coming in here. Well, Trump performs a very interesting sort of service, and whether he's witting or not, who knows? It's impossible to tell, because he's such a volatile, thin-skinned sociopath. You know, it's hard to imagine him having the discipline to do a kind of deliberate thing. So, whether he's been manipulated into it or not, he is performing an invaluable kind of disinformation function. We call it poisoning the well. If he says it, it has to be false, right? So he's been defined as absolutely and always lying. It's kind of the way, you know, decades of anti-Soviet propaganda represented communism. You know, communist propaganda. All propaganda was communist, and it was always false. It was always lies. Everything Trump says is false. Hillary will say after one of his extended riffs at a debate, well, everything that Donald just said is false. Well, actually, often that wasn't true. That was false because some of the things he said were false, right? But mixing them together in that way, you know, enables us all then to brush off everything he said when, in fact, he was absolutely right to say there's no evidence that Russia hacked the DNC emails. That's actually true. And Hillary's response to that was false. And when he says that the system is rigged, there is a very important grain of truth in that because we've had several elections stolen, not by Russia, right? He's wrong in the way he thinks that it's going to be stolen because he keeps talking about voter fraud, which is a Republican meme that goes back to 2000 and has been used to get these voter IDs laws passed in order to disenfranchise more Democrats. Nevertheless, there's a very important element of truth there, that now the entire political establishment and all the press, all the way over to the left, are all strenuously hollering is simply completely groundless, that our elections cannot be hacked or rigged. It can't happen unless Russia does it. Okay, Russia might do it. Okay, they might do it because Putin. He's going to steal our election. He's going to murder our journalists. He's going to rape our women. He's going to kill our buffalo. You know, all that stuff that Putin does because Putin is horrible. Putin is like Hitler, as Hillary has told us, right? So the essential fact is the one that you mentioned, Abby, that there's tremendous amounts of election fraud and vote suppression that go on, that both parties allow it to happen and carry it out, and it was just used to deprive the only legitimately popular candidate in this last election season of the nomination, and that was Bernie Sanders, right? He was, without a doubt, demonstrably the people's choice. He would have wiped up the floor with Donald Trump, okay? Well, they couldn't let that happen because the propaganda narrative they want to sell is it's got to be Hillary. We need neoliberalism to continue. We need to have our first female president in place in order to keep pursuing the Bush-Cheney agenda, only making it much worse. The same way we've had our first African-American president do this, because it will put most Democrats and liberals sound asleep. They'll give him a pass. He can do this. He can start five more wars. He can crack down on civil liberties to an unprecedented extent and use the Espionage Act six times against whistleblowers, right? And he can, you know, get his food policy from Monsanto while Michelle has the organic vegetable garden. And you know, he can do all this stuff. And because he is an articulate, intelligent, African-American Democrat, notionally liberal, it's okay that he does this stuff because he's not a yahoo like Bush, right? Or an ape like Trump, right? So, you know, I think the propaganda narrative is that one, you know, that we have these progressive, diverse presidents who carry out these horrible, horrible programs, right? So for these emails to come out and to give us a look into the kitchen where this disgusting meal is prepared for us, you know, they don't want to go there. They want to talk about that because all the truth is there. It's completely fixed.
I just want to say one way that clearly things have been rigged against Trump. You know, he was a ticking time bomb for, you know, throughout the whole campaign. But they exploited that. He was a carnival act, and the ratings soared. I mean, it was great TV. So the media and, you know, the head of CBS famously said, Trump is great for ratings. But when they realized this clown could actually win, and he was dangerous because he was so reckless, God knows what he would do in the White House, they had all the sex shit on him, ready to go. I mean, we know how that's played. I was in the middle of that during the Clinton impeachment with Salon. So this is how we get things that's how the elites get things done in American, you know, electoral sort of battleground. It's sex. All the things that guy said and did about Muslims, about Mexicans, everything, but none of that really could bring him down until they had that tape. And of course, he had to be saying this shit on the bus with stupid Billy Bush. But because video is the sort of, you know, that's it in America. It's, you know, you live and die by the visual image. So, but look, that was planned. Clearly, Trump's right. They had it ready to go. They let it blow up right before the debate. And it was incredibly effective. So that's the way they played it. But, I mean, there again, how insane is this that we have a situation where the liberal elites in this country, and again, Chris Hedges is very articulate about this, have allowed the system to deteriorate to such an extent. The Democratic Party has abandoned the working class, has abandoned the labor movement, has abandoned the deplorables, as Hillary affectionately called them, in this country, and has allowed a quite significant part of the American population, given how hollowed out American industry and the economy is, to fall into the hands of these dangerous charlatans. And so this guy obviously was too buffoonish to make it all the way. But think about a Trump who's more sophisticated in the future, because they're coming. You know they're on the way. And they'll be much more shrewd and effective next time around. And then we're really going to have to be concerned. America has now a situation where we need scapegoats, we need victims, we need what Noam Chomsky calls non-people, unpeople, to destroy, to exploit and destroy. And it's Muslims suddenly in the last 15 years. Okay, we're going to pick this part of the world. When I was young, Vietnam was suddenly going to invade our country. Gee, that didn't happen, did they? They got integrated somehow into the global economic system. Everyone's fine with Vietnam now. It's a bizarre and sick and toxic culture and system that we live under. It needs to demonize certain populations in order to give us a rationale for continuing our war machine. The war, it's no longer just the military-industrial complex. We are the military-industrial complex. Everything in American society has become militarized. When Colin Kaepernick stood up and challenged the national anthem, all hell broke loose, right? Because we just went along with all that. We would go to sporting events, and now it's not just one anthem you have to stand for. You have to stand in baseball games, the seventh inning for America the Beautiful. You have to watch flyovers, the military flyovers. You have to watch our troops being honored. We don't honor our troops. We throw them away after they're used. And we go to the hot dog stand, and they're showing us ads for the Army. Sign up. It is creepy and Orwellian. And we're like frogs in the boiling water that we haven't realized this. We've raised our children now with these militarized videos, with militarized sports. Everything is militarized. You should read a book by Barbara Ehrenreich's daughter, Rosa Brooks, an amazing and really, I think, disturbing book. She is the daughter of socialists, famous socialists, authors and professor, John Ehrenreich and Barbara Ehrenreich. And she wrote a book. She became a lawyer for the Pentagon during the Clinton and Bush administrations. And she, at different points in her career, actually had to sit in on the drone assassination meetings. Who are we going to kill? Her professor from Yale, who was her mentor, was also involved in those. And he said to her, I'm looking at pictures of young people your age, college-age students, like I'm looking at the applicants for Yale Law School. They're the same age, except these are people we're going to kill. Young Muslims overseas who have decided to resist this overpowering war machine and are now being targeted, and they don't even have all the information for them. They're signature strikes, many of these. They kind of think they're guilty, but we'll never know for sure. And this is Barbara Ehrenreich's daughter sitting in on this. She writes about how American society has become so militarized now, the New Deal programs, the social programs are so devastated. The only functioning part of our society is the military. She lives on a military base because not only did she become a Pentagon lawyer, she married a career officer. They live on a military base in America, and everything is smooth and efficient and clean on that base. As soon as you drive through the gate, she says, you come to wiped out, decaying America, jobless, homeless people. That's what we live in now. It's truly, I think, that's why science fiction, so much of what young people are watching now, it's science fiction, it's horror. I mean, I click around, on Comcast to see what movies to watch. And like 2/3 of this stuff is like scary, nightmarish movies about this dystopian future that we're living.
You just heard Project Censored's roundtable reflecting on the links between media power and political power and the critical role of promoting media freedom and critical media literacy as tools for advancing social justice. In that talk, we heard Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files for Telesur English, Manar Mohawish, founder and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, Professor Mark Crispin Miller of New York University, and David Talbot, Salon.com founder and author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and America's Secret Government. The entire roundtable was live-streamed and recorded by Mint Press News and is available on YouTube. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour's 2017 summer series, broadcast out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We air on participating radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at globalresearch.ca. Music was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.